Chapel service, Thursday, February 11th. Speaker, Thomas Conley. Sermon title, The Sermon.
Let us pray. O thou in whose appointment our life standeth, and in whose grace all our life is born, illumine our minds and hearts this day with thy presence and guiding power, that we might be conformed anew to thy will, and freshly empowered to go forth in our world to perform it. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Before I present our guest, I should like to make a brief announcement. This afternoon, from 3 to 4 o'clock, students are invited to meet with our guest lecturer in the Commons Room of Mackey Hall in a period of discussion. Dr. Trotter will preside over this session, and this will provide you the opportunity to meet in a more intimate fashion the guest of the week. When I first met Tom Conley at the seminary in Louisville a good many years ago, I recognized immediately that he belonged to that elect company I have found in every seminary, the Department of Ecclesiastical Wildlife. Well, now you've heard him, you know I'm telling the truth. But frankly, I must say that this week has vastly extended my debt to this man, to the joys and the commitments of a cherished friendship which I have experienced over these years. I have now added the obligation which comes with having shared with all of you in these luminous hours when a man's depth, range, and vision are brought to the task of Christian teaching and proclamation. Horace Bushnell once said that preaching is the bursting forth of life, which first of all has burst upon us from on high, with insight, wit, and perception. We have been led this week to view the magnitude of our task and to understand afresh that religious work will always be an uncomfortable struggle between skill and the transcendent mystery of God. So today, with renewed anticipation, we open ourselves to the stimulus and the inspiration of another hour in this series and in the great tradition of the Adams Lecture. After the anthem, Mr. Conley will come to you.
John Carlton, I thank you for that introduction. John Carlton, to me, is the epitome of grace and charm. He gives credence to that gentleman and scholar. Sometimes cliche, but in him, it is living and breathing, and very real. I thank you for what you said. Let me express appreciation also for our music, for the ensemble, Dr. Johnson, the organist. Music is one of the ways that I work it. I'm not worshiping usually during the sermon, I am working. Therefore, I worship through the prayers, I worship through the liturgy, I worship through the music. Fred Swan, who is organist at Riverside in New York, was at our place last week for recital, and that was a magnificent time of worship for me without any spoken word. Now, I'm staying at Reeves House this week. It's a charming place, a fine place. I was taking a shower this morning, and in the shower at Reeves House, there is one candle in the tub. It screws out up and down for the velocity of the water, to both sides for fighting cold. And so I was luxuriating in a nice warm shower with my back soaking up all of that, and I inadvertently squirted the soap out of my hands. I bent over to retrieve the soap and accidentally pushed the handle to one side. And what had been a luxurious warm shower became a splash of ice-cold water onto regions of my anatomy that God never made to be surprised in that fashion. I tell you, I shall be awake all day long. I may not sleep for the rest of the week. I delivered several benedictions before I turned around and got that thing squared away. I shall not drop my soap anymore. All that to say that I hope I have not given you a cold shot by immersing you in the liturgy the way I did yesterday. I gave you the full load. From the dialogue that I've had with some of you, let me say that worship in the liturgical tradition and being possessed of an ecumenical spirit do not detract from the best in our Baptist tradition and heritage. We lose nothing, I think, as Baptists when we add liturgy. Now, we are all worried about what we're going to lose when a new idea comes to us. First thing, not most of the time, isn't that exciting or is that new or something like that, but what am I going to lose? It's a part of our Freudian makeup of being endowed with a thirst for security. We lose nothing. Like marriage, I enhanced my selfhood when I married that lovely Betty Bishop from Somerville, South Carolina. I did not lose who I am, nor any of my traditions, nor any of my heritage. All of those Baptist core of distinctives that Morgan Patterson gave me and us at that Baptist course in Southern Seminary are still intact, every one of them. I thought I'd better say that. Today, the sermon. Our assumptions, theological and otherwise, are those bases from which we operate and identify who we are and how we see the preaching pastoral path. Assumptions will be reflected in what we do in the pulpit. Reflect. The context for all of our worship and preaching is structured via the Christian year and the lectionary. Yesterday. These are the roots of both the worship and the homiletical path. Remember, the context is not grounded in something borrowed from across the street, but indeed something borrowed from across the centuries. So the vestments and the paraments are in place, the robe hangs ready for next Sunday's Resurrection Day celebration, and it is time for the sermon to be conceived and before the week's end to be given birth. For this section together, then, the sermon. Now, immediately I can turn to my business board and know the limitations of a this is how I do it kind of session. But there may be a helpful hint along the way that will become your servant. If so, enjoy that thing. I think we never get too experienced nor too old to learn something. And I hope that you believe that. I truly do. That's what I live with, that way. I prepare a 6-month preaching schedule with the themes and the scriptures, the times of the Christian year all listed, the communions listed, and give it to the congregation. People know then what to expect. They also know, one woman said, that at least you have given some thought to what you're going to say, and that helps me to listen a little bit better. In preparing the schedule and making the first pass through the text, 3 lessons every Sunday, Old Testament, Epistle, and Gospel lessons. There are times when an entire outline or a cogent point or an illustration simply will jump out for consideration, and note is made of that for future reference. A 6-month approach is a great help in selecting material. For when a theme on a subject is anticipated, for example, 2 months in advance, and the morning newspaper has a 4-part series on that particular subject, that can be trimmed and stored for an appropriate use. For this connects with the congregation. They have seen it. They have read it. It is an intricate part of who they are. They identify. Normally, preparation for the sermon with me begins 10 days before the fact. Friday morning, 10 days before I deliver that sermon, I plant the seed in preparation for the final harvest. And so some earnest consideration of the text is beginning in germination. Saturday and Sunday are preparation days for the sermon at hand. Monday is my day off, which I observe religiously. But all of those 3 days are synthesizing days on the subject. Process, no matter how slight, has begun. The seed is going, and although it has not burst the sod, it is burst the sod, it is there. Tuesday morning, the texts are reread, and notes relevant to the subject made much back are reviewed, and some in-depth synthesizing begins. By the way, I do not see or talk to anyone during the morning, unless it is absolute emergency or death. The study is for study. Counseling and visiting and other duties like that are done in the afternoon. I have observed this for 40 years. The first obligation of the politician, we are told, is to get elected. The first obligation of the preacher is to study and not to preach until he or she has. Recently, I tuned in a late-night television station. A preacher was on there, and it was advent. He was in a very polished manner, I thought, and began to be getting ended with a quote by Christina Rossetti. What can I give him for as I am? If I were a shepherd, I would bring a lamb. If I were a wise man, I would do my part. And what can I give him? Give him my heart. Well, not all of us can do that, right? It's a respected piece of work. But I think it probably has grown rather flat from over years. I think you could have done better. I think he reached back into the barrel instead of down into his study. And too much of that dishonors the past and the gospel. So Tuesday morning is spent writing furiously anything that comes to mind on the theme. Overarching that, the Christian year, the text, the people to whom I have been speaking, my own personal pilgrimage, events in the world and in the community, all this is written down in brief paragraphs, sometimes only 1 or 2 sentences, any stories, illustrations, quips, plays, poems, art, anything that is remotely germane to the theme is written down and numbered. These comprise the notes, page 1, page 2, page 3, everything numbered. Then back to the text. Are there meanings that yet need to be explored? What needs to be said in terms of message from the Word? Exegesis, historical critical material, the facts of the text are all added to the notes and numbers. Wider reading is done at this point to be sure all the facets are covered. More addition to the notes takes place. I have what I call a writer's work job, which is a host of materials that I have gathered over 20 years of reading, and that is consulted, more notes, more numbering. Thus, then, the determination is made. How will I say it? Straight up, or in a very intriguing style? Once that is determined, how will it be put together? The outline is ready then to be done. The outline is abbreviated because of the extensive notation. I may just put one line. The incarnation is a model for us, and then follow that with two notes, number 12. Or maybe there's a transition in four words, transition, notes number 5. If all the notes aren't used, they are saved then for the time. Some of them is ready to be written. All needed material is pulled together, usually sometimes from the wingtip. This is important. I catalog all my books with an intricate filing system for subjects, and the writer's workshop that I mentioned before is a collection by subject in loose-leaf notebooks of bits and pieces of reading, all documented. If I read a book on preaching and it has an existing illustration on love, then I bracket that, put www in your margin, writer's workshop, love, give it to the secretary. If I finish reading a book, I put it in the tray, and pick it up, and go page by page with the third of the writer's workshop. It's now grown to some 3 huge volumes of literature before. So with all that material is collected, then a full manuscript is written. Now, I know what Clyde Sand and some other very fine preachers say about the manuscript. And I know the press of the pastor's scarcity. But for me, the manuscript is absolutely essential. It may not work for everybody, but even if you don't use the full manuscript, there is a kind of discipline there that I think we dare not fail to bring to the people. Helps the preacher, I think, the practical advantages to me. Helps the preacher to process the material internally as it's being written, the sermon substance is being worked and handled and fondled. It's a remembrance agent, a final preparation that becomes very significant. If you have written something, you are bound, I think, to remember it better. It becomes part of you. Writing a full manuscript also hones the thought. Rereading the penned words reveals rambling and disjointed and disconnected thought. It's easier to see a flaw than it is to hear it. We do not talk generally in complete sentences. You ever listen to a tape of yourself in conversation? We don't talk in complete sentences, but we must think in complete thought, and the written manuscript helps to secure that. Full manuscript also points up imbalance. If you've got 2 points that are required to make your theme, you wind up with 6 pages on one point and 2 pages on the other. You know, obviously, some revision needs to be made. The manuscript also helps us with alternative expression. Preachers like Trant have pointed out there is talk and there is written talk. They are different. But instead of that being a problem, I see that as a magnificent. For these expressions can add flavor and flair to the sermon. It is not necessarily a plus to present the special transcendent Lord of the universe in the flat talk of conversational English found at the local lunch counter. And as it plays, there's no manuscript. With the manuscript also, there is a matter of future reference for preaching and writing and developmental overview. I don't know if you've done this, but it's an intriguing thing to go back to manuscripts that you have done 10 years before and see that a developmental process. It charts our own growth. Outlines don't do that. Our shop also has a training sermon ministry through which the sermons are duplicated and sent out on a mailing list and made available to the congregation. Writing the sermon in full one time is the easier way for me to approach this. If I had to preach from an outline and then come back on Monday and hone that and write it down, that would interfere with my process to the point of grace. A manuscript helps us to know also whether it is we've done the preparation. It's a way to facilitate discipline. If I have an outline, I may think I'm prepared. But if I have written everything down, I can see whether or not preparation is complete. Now, I don't mean to suggest here that a manuscript assures discipline or study or preparation. Manuscript preaching sometimes doesn't apply either. But the chances of applying are greatly enhanced. The words are on paper as well as in part of time. A manuscript also keeps us from throwing in a side that may get us into trouble. One of our number in Southern Baptist life some months back made some remarks I seem to remember about Jews and their prayers and their noses. Huh? Now, if those scripts had been put in a manuscript and written down, the preacher would probably have stricken the remarks in reviewing the manuscript. Well, that's not the case, is it? That's the opposite. But finally, the manuscript helps relieve our preaching from the emotional highs and lows we have as ministers. There's not a one of us here who is always up when it's time to give the word. I know what old Jimmy Kissinger is going through today. 3 years ago, I went to George Baptist Hospital and bought these two bypasses. I'm really bored of it. Nobody takes a chance to pay for medical care. See, I can't even pay for the treatment. I've had some good days and some bad days sometimes. If a bad day happens to fall on a Sunday morning when I climb out of bed, I have to depend on pumping adrenaline or emotional inspiration to get me through an outline, I'm dead. Very good choice of words, but that. A manuscript helps tremendously, I think, to focus and carry my thoughts and my feelings when the emotional state has stumbled. A manuscript is a springboard. It gives me a little more leverage. I'm not always tied to it, but it does give me some bounce. I can dive a little bit deeper at times if I get on the springboard. The important point, I think, is the manuscript ought to be gone over and over and processed again and again and again. It ought never to be just there. The delivery should be thoroughly practiced, I think. I try to use the manuscript to introduce me to a basic thought or a basic idea or to a paragraph and then finish that out with remembrance of the stuff that I have processed. If we don't do that, it is usually lectury and very stiff, and that's probably why some preachers have developed an aversion to it. It doesn't have to be that way. Again, the manuscript is not the only way to do it, I know that, but it may be worth at least a solid try for some of these reasons that I've given before other methods are used. It is important that these teachers know what is our style as well as what is not our style. And Van Gaal some years ago wrote a work in which he talked about the me and the not me. It is important that we know what is. Perhaps in all of this discussion, not enough material has been attention has been paid to the preacher's material. I know that the sermon is more than material, but it is at least that. Therefore, we preachers must develop a way to keep the quality stuff, not all of it, but the quality stuff that we read and experience. The writer's workshop is one way that I have done this. Sermons, too, need to be kept so that they can be used to the maximum. I know this is sort of nitty-gritty stuff, but sometimes I have been helped in my pastoral ministry by the nitty-gritty and the day-to-day stuff. So let me share the way I process it, whatever it may be worth. The sermons are indexed by text, by subject, and by chronological use. Parable 17, for example, is the 17th sermon I've done on the parable. Now, say I use an illustration out of the writer's workshop in the church section for this sermon on parable. It was the 43rd century in the church. So in the sermon, just after the illustration has been used, the secretary puts the parenthesis, church number 43. And in the index page in front of the church section in the writer's workshop, put parable 17. which lets me know that that illustration was used in the sermon, parable number 17. And the chronological index lets me know when and where the sermon was preached. So we can go back to a place, 10 dozen times, and never repeat the same illustration. We are stewards of all that we have met. Our material deserves a very disciplined approach. Just as the sermon does. As a matter of fact, undisciplined stewardship of material will frequently lead to an undisciplined sermon with illustrations just a half bubble off center and stories that properly belong in next week's text instead of this week's. But there's still more to the sermon. There is a matter of the very preaching style. Climb into the pulpit Sunday after Sunday with the same old approach, introduction, body of sermon, 1 point, 2 points, a nice story and point. It's the poor operation as well as ourselves. As I'm thinking John Carlson today, sometimes I want to preach for me. Not only in content, but also in style. If stagnation begins to get to us, then think what has happened to the congregation. Share with you some styles that have been useful to me through the years. They may be alternatives to keep the words from being visual and flat. Now, I am not naive enough to believe that changing styles will keep preaching from being Christian. But sometimes a lack of styles will contribute when such triviality has occurred. Not all of these styles are Christian. They are not all self-contained. At times there is an overlapping. It is possible for a sermon to be classified in one or two or even three of these, I suppose. I list them for whatever benefit that may be to you. The first is the auto-dimension. The auto-dimension. This style is characterized by personal thoughts and reflections of the person who speaks in the sermon. What would it have been like to have come upon Bathsheba staring out the palace window one morning? David has died. Solomon is on the throne. And this wife, lover, woman, mother, filled with her reflections about what it means to have been in all those roles and more. For instance, she could have her tell about her and David trying to handle the guilt from Uriah. Very pregnant with this child, and I was not sure that God had heard me. I felt so much alone. My family turned against me, and while I had dozens of servants around me, I felt lonely. Without family. Without family. I used to find myself asleep. I had always thought of being a mother. I remember the night so clearly when David, who seemed to understand criticism and trouble so well, took me in his arms and told me about life. trouble, conflict, pain, they are an intricate part of life. It's always been that way. Man's response to God's creation has always been touched with tragedy. And then he reminded me of the grand old story of Adam and Eve and what went wrong. All to say they were so good. Judgment comes from those people who are sinners. As a matter of fact, I think I have quoted Philip Williams in this thing about the city of the city. And it's called the first city of the first city of the city. This is an arresting quality of this style, I think. It stays on target historically and biblically. It can be imagined given the fact. What does Bathsheba have thought in reflection on her life? Another possibility is to give the prodigal son a name. Can you think about what his name was? I gave him a name, Micah. Biblical name. And I had his mother, not mentioned in Luke 15 at all, reflect on how she saw the approaching conflict. You know, mothers know the sense of sibling rivalry that's approaching, the dynamics between father and son. She sees all of that. And so it was son, it's that son, and she said, I won't get into all that, but all the relationships in a family, if you have a sermon on the family, all the dynamics are there. Sibling rivalry, husband-wife relationship, father-son, mother-son. This is not a cute style of preaching. I don't look at it this way at all. It is a creative thing, but it is not cute. Then there is the auto-dimensional, there is the narrative. Old Fred Craddock, he was a marvelous preacher. And others have approached preaching as stories. They have taught us much. The narrative is not just telling a story, it is the story told. Now, one of my favorites here is a character that I have developed named Dr. J. Hardy. My people always look forward to a sermon on Dr. J. Hardy. He's a Baptist minister in a city. He's older than I, and therefore he's wiser. He runs into folks at the old corner drugstore, one that still has a fountain, you know? He talks to the woman behind there who helps to the door. They talk about all that. Somebody comes in there and goes to the drug office. Or he's waiting in the church library. And you can also bring in things in these situations that have happened recently. I'll give you an example of it. Listen carefully, and you will hear it. Something that happened yesterday. Waiting in the church library. Jay Hardy pushed open the door to the church parlor and felt the rush of memories escape against him. In his senior days with a Baptist congregation, how many times had he met in this parlor, which served also as library? He used the new staff members, a woman's meeting, a meeting with a group who were after world peace and ready to fight for it. Deacon's meetings, he remembered, a growth group over in that corner, an advanced theology seminar that he thoroughly enjoyed. They were all there, and like ghosts, they rose up to meet him and stepped across the threshold. J. Jay Hardy enjoyed getting away from the study and rambling about in the parks of the church building by this time, but this time he was there to meet his wife for a quick lunch in the afternoon before the remainder of his day was spent in pastoral care, in counseling and visitation, and then looking at the bid with the business manager for someone to repair the sewer line. Ah, the nobility of the office. Jay was early, intentionally so, for his luncheon date with his wife, and so he sat and rested for a moment, scanning the room with a kind of peaceful and fulfilled sense that he was pastor. Suddenly the door was ajar, and there stood Marcy, 17, long blonde hair, blue eyes, vivacious spirit.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Hardy, I didn't know anyone was here. I'll just, oh, no, Marcy, come in. I'm glad to see you. Come in.
Well, I don't want to disturb you. I was just going to do some reading.
A 17-year-old reading in the church parlor library on such a lovely summer day? Well, that sounds fair. Come on in and sit with me for a few minutes. What are you reading, if I may ask?
Sure. Well, you mentioned lessons up ahead a lot in your sermons, and I got a couple of these books, and Good Men Suffer and Sleep with Suffer. Are they really good? Oh, they are fine, aren't you? As a matter of fact, I was in a friend's office yesterday. He was a teacher, a professor at a seminary, and he had another book that I had not seen by Morris Ashcraft called The Will of God. You ought to get that one, too. So, how did the funeral go for Eric last week? Now, Eric was a friend of Marcy's. He lived on the outskirts of the city. He had been killed tragically the week before in a motorboat on Lake Fisher. The man was drunk, and he drove into Eric's boat and cut it in half. Eric was injured and drowned before anyone could rescue him. Jay linked Eric's death with Marcy's report. Oh, the funeral was okay. Marcy's voice was flat, her eyes fell with tears. Just okay, asked Jay.
Well, to be perfectly honest, I heard some things that really bothered me about evil and good and God and death and all. I mean, you know, Dr. Hardy, I just haven't been close to death before. My grandparents on both sides of my family are still alive. All my uncles and aunts are alive. I've just never really encountered death like this. And what some of those folks said...
What did you hear, Marcy? Jay had a pretty good idea of what she had heard, but he knew the minister at the church where the funeral was held, and he was quite a different breed from Jay in many ways.
Some of the things people said at the funeral really got to me. I mean, is there a purpose for everything? Do things always work out for the best? They kept saying that, and that Eric's death was really... for the best, somehow. Do you believe that, Dr. Hardy?
No, Marcy, I don't believe that. I know the sentiment. I know these people are sincere. But I don't believe that.
And some of them kept saying how the Lord was really with Joanne and Pete and Francis. You know, they were with Eric in the boat. But wasn't the Lord with me, too? Why would he let this happen to Eric and not to the others? Do you think we have a time to go? And it was Eric. Do you think there's somebody up there pulling numbers out of a bucket? If God stopped death from taking the other three, why didn't he stop it from taking Eric? What they were saying just didn't make sense. With whom?
Well, I'm not finished with that. But everything you need to say about theology, Dr. J. Hardy went down all the old cliches about death, God, evil. Now, those are heavy subjects. So I always have a relief character. This time, it was a lady who came in with sort of a fifth street husband. She was just sort of grand the church. She was in there to redecorate. And so she heard all the advice that Dr. J. Hardy ran. She became sort of a tradition.
You mean by that?
Got all men out of shape and some things. J. Hardy was special. You need some kind of relief. I have taken, demythologized hell, and the concept of Satan through the character of J. Hardy. Still there. As far as I know, unless they had a deacon's meeting while I was gone, I... Say anything you need to say, and you can put some heady stuff there, because they're saying it to one another, and you don't make them a frontal approach. Then format monologues are also filled with possibilities. I call these format because the form is the distinctive characteristic of the sermon. It carries the capacity for involving a congregation on a different level of listening. And these activate the imagination, and when that is done, hearing is heightened and through, sometimes threatening from a frontal approach, is more easily assimilated. I'll just use just a very brief part of one. Format monologue, form of a letter. Here's the beginning. Jesus Bar Joseph, care of Joseph's Cabinet Shop, Nazareth, California. Digging. The Jerusalem Chamber of Commerce regrets to inform you that your nomination for the Young Man of the Year has not been received. We felt compelled to give your nomination for this high honor some consideration, since it was Nicodemus, a well-known member of Sanhedrin, who nominated you. However, after careful scrutiny by our screening committee, it is felt that we dare not give your nomination serious consideration. For our award to the Young Man of the Year is given one who has contributed something to his society, and there is no evidence that he has made any contribution to your society. On the contrary, we sent some of our committee members to your hometown for a preliminary investigation, and what we found there was disturbing. We found, for example, that your family heritage is extremely hazy. There are some persistent and ugly rumors about your family, and especially about your beginnings. Now, we don't believe every rumor, but in this case, they certainly cast a shadow of doubt on your background. You understand, of course, that a man with a sterling family life is required for our image. We also traced your lineage and found Rahab the harlot in your family background. You certainly had no control over that, just unfortunate to say the least. Well, it's signed, let's see if I can remember, Simon Bar Abram, president of the Jerusalem Chamber of Commerce. That, you can delineate every way that Jesus struck his culture and stopped. And he did just that. I also have one some years back, I think, when I first started this book, on a pulpit committee, writing the Apostle Paul and telling him all the reasons that he was not considered for that book. Now, that's a good one. Multidimensional style is when there are more than one person involved in the sermon and each one gives his or her thought. The multidimensional. I'm running out of time, folks. I don't know what to do with this thing. The dualistic monologue involves two people. For example, Jesus coming into Jericho sees Zacchaeus in the tree. And it's almost as in double slow motion as Jesus approaches. So you have the half of the sermon, Jesus' reflections about Zacchaeus. But the second half, with a very creative segue, as I call them, that is a transition, have Zacchaeus say, "There he is, finally getting to move. I wonder if he knows me." And how that can be. The syllogistic monologue involves the perspectives of three persons. Peter, James, and John have just been selected by Jesus as the first. They're going to take them off the trail. Each one reflects on what this means. Peter, the quadroscopic monologue has four persons giving their perspectives of a singular event. Lazarus is ill, so he begins to think about, where is Jesus? Just when I need him. Mary, Martha. Well, there is These are all monologues. Then there is the dialogue sermon. I treated this in this little book that I did a few years back called Two in the Pulpit, Sermons and Dialogue. It's now out of print. It's published by Word. Before ABC bought them. Let me just sort of do it very briefly and then do the book. I've always wondered if Jesus ever saw the adulteress that he saved from the Pharisees. He ever saw her. So I have her seek him out. I named her Miriam. And Jesus, through this, examines with her the psychological and spiritual dimensions in the title Somebody's Daughter. She had a father who didn't love her, and she was always trying to be a sister to him. Somebody's Wife. Hello. Someone told me I might find you here. This is a leper's house. Isn't it, Beverly? Yes, it is, if it matters any, but it's very late, and it's not wise for a woman to be out in the streets at this time of... Are you kidding, sir? Don't you recognize me? I'm the woman you saved from the Pharisees today. I was almost stoned at your feet, and you asked me if it's safe on the street. Oh, I'm sorry. The light is dim. I really didn't. The moon is just behind the clouds. I'm sorry. By the way, Joe, what are you doing sitting out here? The night is quiet. And I use it to reflect on the affairs today. Funny you should use that word, affairs. Oh, excuse me. I forgot to ask you. Do you mind my being here at night like this, I mean, and my being a woman and an adulteress to boot? No, I don't mind. I've had many late night visitors, but most of them were concerned lest I spoil their reputations. It's quite a turn to find someone concerned for mine for a change. Well, it might not be the best time for me to have come to see you, but I had to see you. I was in bed with a man not my husband today. An adulteress I am, but at any rate, I'm not. You saved my life, and I wanted to thank you. So I did say goodbye. Sit with me. Tell me how you came to be at my house. Well, there goes all the information.
I go down there.
Of what possibly happened? I know that because I am there. And I sit with people who are found in bed as a doctor. Let me say, these are occasional variant preaching styles. I do not walk into the pulpit every Sunday with one of these things. Today? Otherwise, you'll go out of here saying, Conley's up a tree somewhere. He's not dipping. He's not dipping with both oars in the water. You may say that anyway. Most of the time, I have a consistent, rather steady style. There are times when I need, or something lends itself to it, snatches at me, says, this is what Jay Harding needs to apply. Let me say this. We are made in the image of God. God is a creative God. First chapters of Genesis, bara. Only word used with God, never for our creativity, I understand. But if we are made in his image, then we also have a thrust for creativity. It is a divine gift. In many, and not in most instances, I think it is ignored. It lies dormant in the heart of us creatures. It is shelf-stocked and dusted only occasionally. And if we be stewards of what we know and who we are and what we have within us, namely an innate creativity, then we owe it to God and to ourselves to plumb the depths of this hiddenness there concealed and make it known. I know exactly why we don't. It's good because it's done under or uncovered. There's a dimension in the selfhood that we haven't got yet. It absolutely uncorks me sometimes to find out what I got. That's scary. God expects us to be creative. The gospel deserves it. We need it. I believe the people will respond.
Now unto God's gracious mercy and protection we commit you. And may the blessing of God Almighty, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit be with you and remain with you always.